5, if that's okay with the committee. And we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 655. Janet, could you give us a brief rundown on that bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's what they're looking for.
Mr. Chairman, with Senate Bill 655, and you should be looking at the AM growth version of the bill, would match the boundaries of the Salem Area Mass Transit District to the urban growth boundaries and allow those urban growth boundaries to be changed allow the Mass Transit District boundaries to be changed when the urban growth boundaries are changed. When the district was formed in 1977, its boundaries and in statute, they had to match the urban growth boundary in place at that time. And since the boundary of the urban boundary has changed, the district is requesting this bill and would be able to match the boundaries, and their service area and taxing area would match urban growth boundaries. Mr. Chair, there is a fiscal impact statement in place also for the AIM growth bill.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, could I ask Janet a question before we start? What was the vote in the Senate on this bill?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure we can find it.
We can get that vote for you before maybe Brad can check it out.
All right.
Thank you. I have list here with two names on it, and I recognize one person whose name isn't on the list. Welcome. But first, we have John Whittington, and I suppose that's one of you and two other people.
It is. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to introduce Marcia Kelly, Vice President of Transit Board, and Ben Featherston of the Transit District Legal Council, joining me this morning. And I think the answer to Representative Walker's question is that 26-0 was the vote at the Senate.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning on Senate Bill 655. My name is John Whittington. I'm the Transit Development Manager for the Salem Area Mass Transit District. Senate Bill 655 applies only to our transit district, and I will take just a few minutes of your time to explain, why this bill is beneficial to the people of our district. Salem Area Transit's boundary was established in statute 20 years ago as the 1977 Urban Growth Boundary, or UGB, of the Salem-Kaiser area. It was set up as a static boundary, unchanging despite the many shifts in housing and employment concentrations and land use designations that lead cities and counties to exercise their statutory authority to initiate changes in their urban growth boundary from time to time. Such changes in the Salem and Kaiser have taken place several times since 1977, but the Salem transit boundary remains static and now out of date. 20 years from now, or 50 years from now, the Salem transit boundary will be unchanged, regardless of how the urban growth areas have changed, unless Senate Bill 655 or a similar statutory amendment allows us to adjust to the times. We're behind the times even today. Areas which have been removed from the UGB due to their rural or undevelopable nature are still within our old boundary and are receiving property tax bills for transit service that they are unlikely to ever receive. Conversely, other areas which have been added to the UGB and are currently being developed for housing or industrial purposes remain outside our antiquated boundary and cannot be offered transit services. Senate Bill 655 would provide a permanent solution to correct this inequity. It updates our boundary to today's Salem-Kaiser UGB and enables the transit boundary to change in accordance with future adjustments. As cities and counties see fit to amend the UGB to reflect the realities of their development needs, Salem Area Transit's boundary will change accordingly and will remain current with the growth patterns of the community jurisdictions. All of the stringent public controls that apply to the movement of urban growth boundaries will pertain to the boundaries of the transit district as well. The board and staff of Salem Area Mass Transit District feel that Senate Bill 655 will enable the district to better and more responsibly serve the current and future residents of the Salem and Kaiser area. We respectfully urge the House Transportation Committee's support for this important action. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whittington. Is there any questions?
I have one.
Hill and then Logan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. how can you extend the boundaries of the transit district today in the absence of this? So.
Well, that's been Representative, Chair Montgomery, Representative Hill. Currently, the
transit. For the record, would you mind giving your name?
Sorry. I'm Ben Featherston, legal counsel for the Salem Transit District. The answer to the question is currently the transit district cannot change its boundaries. Its boundaries are established as the 1977 urban growth boundary and cannot be different than that. So we can't change them.
Representative Logan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question, as the boundary expands, then brings in a taxing district, then, I suppose, for your mass transit. Is that correct?
Actually, the changes that happened since 1977 in the urban growth boundary would result in a constriction of the district. The district would be smaller under this change than it is today, and we would actually collect less taxes in the district than we do today.
Oh, it's not enlarging your district, then.
That's
smaller.
Look, and it's not enlarging the district. It's actually makes it smaller because of the changes that have happened. It could become larger if future changes in the urban growth boundary include more areas.
Follow up.
Yes, yes.
So under this bill, it gives you flexibility then in handling your transit needs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Logan, it really doesn't give us flexibility. It gives the district. It changes the district as changes are made in the urban growth boundary. Those changes are initiated at the jurisdictional, the city and county level, approved by the Department of Land and Conservation and Development.
One more follow-up, yes. And then I think I have it. Well, currently then, you are taxing people according to the old four transit, according to the boundaries that were set in 1977, is that what you're saying?
Chairman, Representative Logan, yes, that is correct. We are taxing people within the 1977 urban growth boundary, even though that boundary does not reflect the growth that has happened and the changes that have happened since then.
And if the urban growth boundary is drawn in and your transit district is smaller, does that affect your taxing situation? And
Mr. Chairman, Representative Logan, yes, it does. If that boundary is drawn in and tightened, and properties were taken out of the urban growth boundary, we would not be taxing those properties any longer. We would only tax the properties within the boundary line.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Another question, Logan?
No, I think that was kind of, I was trying to see where they kind of
the
line on the taxation as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see in the original version of the bill, it was more of a sort of process that would allow the transit district to go through a public process with its patrons to determine in terms of how they're going to expand. And the bill as we are today vests that responsibility for expanding this to the legislature, and we're going to require that it be expanded. Do you have any intention to deliver service to those areas that are not currently being served that would be moved into this and would have an obligation to support the transit district? I mean, is there an expansion plan so we could look out for the citizens of Salem?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hill, I'm Marcia Kelly, Vice President of the Transit District. At the current time, our goal is to have service within the district within a quarter of a mile of residences. As we expand our service, we always look for areas that are going to be very very efficiently served with transit. We would be happy to provide you a map to show you the little tweaks on what has gone out and what has come in. But I wouldn't expect us to do any expansion of service in the very near future, maybe 5-10 years out, unless it would be with intergovernmental contracts. Thank you very much. Just allergies.
is there a revenue impact in terms of how much revenue would this generate for the transit district?
I believe at the current time it is going to be a negative revenue. We are on a property tax. We are not on a payroll tax. And more land will go out than would be brought in under the current estimate. It's John says it's about $15,000 revenue negative for us.
This statute that we're amending, is it just particular to the Salem Transit District? It won't affect other transit districts.
That is correct. Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, when the district was formed, we were formed under a separate statute than other mass transit districts in the state.
Thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it. Did you have anything, gentlemen? Thank you for being. Did you have a poll? Okay, I didn't look up there. You always had a question. That's good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would it be reasonable to assume then that you are now potentially serving some customers that are not in your 1977 boundary, and you're not serving some customers that are in your 1977 boundary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jefflin, we do not serve customers outside of our boundaries because we cannot serve customers outside of our boundaries. We are not serving some customers who are outside of our boundaries. One of my constituents, because they are outside of the current UGD and where they live, it's not feasible to have service. This change would get that person out of our boundaries, and he wouldn't be paying taxes for a service that he would not be able to have. He's not quite within a quarter of a mile of a bus route, but because of the topography on where he lives, it's not feasible to serve him.
Is the, in the Salem area, is the UGB, well, in a sense, synonymous with the city boundary?
Mr. Chair and Representative Devlin, no, it is not with the city boundary. It is the Salem-Kaiser UGB. It's Salem-Kaiser and the unincorporated, the in the urban growth boundary area, east of town and south of town.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I have another person signed up, Roger Martin, says if needed. And if I have to make the decision, I don't think it's needed, but you're welcome to come forward. Thank you, Mr. Martin, for being here. If it goes sideways, we may need you, so thank you very much. Are there any other questions? No one wants to testify. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 655. And for the information for Representative Walker, it was 26-0 in the Senate, so Brad just double-checked. Not that we didn't trust the gentleman, but we did double-check. We open the work session on Senate Bill 655A. What's the pleasure of Representative Hill?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. It'll be a no on this. I don't support mass transit, but I think in terms of the way this is crafted, in terms of coming to the legislature and asking for an expansion of boundaries rather than, I think, the way that it was drafted originally, which would have the district go through a public process with their own patrons and expand the district, is a better process than to come here and have us expand it for them. And they should be having this discussion with those that they serve rather than with us.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. President Wells.
I guess with due respect to what Representative Hill said, I disagree. This is really not an expansion. I think it's allowing the district to conform their district with the urban growth boundary as that expands or that contracts. And so it's not necessarily an expansion. It's just so that they can continue in the future only serving, as I understand, the area within the urban growth boundary, whatever that is.
Any further discussion? Pleasure of the committee. We have before us Senate Bill 655A. President Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, if you're ready for a motion,
yes,
I'll move Senate Bill 655A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Devlin moves Senate Bill 655A to the floor with a due pass. Any further discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
Representative
Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
No.
Representative
Crump.
Aye.
Representative Connell.
I'll pass for a moment.
Representative
Representative Montgomery.
Aye.
Representative Crumlin.
Aye.
Senate Bill 655 is passed with full to do pass recommendation. Representative Wells, would you like to carry it? Thank you. Representative Wells will carry. Now we'll get back on our agenda. Thank you all for waiting. We will now open the work session on House Bill 58, Senate Bill 583A. We had a public hearing on this bill Monday. We have about four people who had signed up and couldn't. We didn't have time for them, so I thank you all for coming back. And we'll just start right down our list here with those people. Ms. Janet, do you have any information to pass on to us before we get into the work session?
Mr. Chair,
these are invited testimony now, we will call them instead of a public hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to transmit to the members two things. I did receive yesterday 14 separate calls in support of Senate Bill 583, and they wanted me to let members know of their support from individuals. And I have today a letter from the governor regarding Senate Bill 583. There is a representative from his office here, but I'll pass out the letter.
Okay, that'll be available for the public also if they wanted to. This individual want to testify. It's highly unusual that the governor will send us a letter. He didn't send us a letter supporting the transportation package. That's very interesting. Thank you. We will continue with our work session. And the first up on our work session will be Teresa Hepker. And thank you. And Lyle, if you'd like to come with us, fine. That's up to you. She's taking your place, so you can sit alongside of her. For the benefit of you who have not seen this letter, and before you start testifying, I will.
Thank you.
Okay, it's the letter from the governor opposing this, strongly opposing Senate Bill 583A in its current form. So you all know what's here, and there will be some on the slide table if you want a copy of it. Good morning. Thank you for driving over this last evening, and didn't get stuck on the freeway because you took the long way here.
Yes, I did. Thank you, Representative Montgomery and committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Hepker, and I'm here today to represent Bike Pack of Oregon. I understand during the Monday hearing that some questions arose that I might be able to help with, and I've also brought a sheet that I think many of you may not have seen, which might help illustrate some of the concepts we talked about regarding the subject of helmets and helmet laws. It's my opinion, after being involved in this issue for about 22 years, that we're subject to helmet laws today because in the 60s and 70s we had a big explosion of motorcycle popularity, a lot of novice riders, a lot of accidents, a lot of injuries, a lot of deaths. And the response at that point was to pass a helmet law in many states. A lot of things have happened since that time to make motorcycling safer, many of those at the behest of motorcyclists themselves. Probably the most significant of those are better motorcyclist licensing procedures, and also the rider education program, which Oregon has a very good one, one of the best in the nation. Rider education has spread across the United States to where I think 46 states now have a rider education program. In the 60s and 70s, we had no licensing. We had no rider education. We had an explosion of a very popular transportation device that nobody knew how to ride. And I think we're paying for that today. The charts that you're looking at here, the top one shows motorcycle registrations. They were high in the early years, have been declining. In fact, this last year is the first year when we've seen an increase in the number of registrations in the state of Oregon by a small amount for a long time. The second chart shows accidents compared to the number of students trained in the rider education program. And you'll see where those two lines cross. They have a really large rise in students trained. This last year, 1988, there were more than 2,000 students trained in that year alone. And we think that this is having a real impact on the safety of motorcyclists in the state of Oregon. The third chart shows Oregon accidents and fatalities. And one of the things I'd like to point out about this is that black line, how it jiggles up and down. Part of the reason for that is Oregon is what you might call a small statistical sample. When we're talking about having between 70 people die in motorcycle accidents in 1977 or so, and 22, 24 people in recent years, that's a very small statistical sample. It's difficult to show trends when you have that few numbers, which is why we get down to the last chart, which looks at blend statistics from all the states. And this is a little overlay. Got two little pieces here. You can turn the little sheet of paper away. The top chart portrays states without helmet laws, and the one underneath is states with helmet laws. When you take a little piece of paper out and lay those two transparencies together, you'll see there's very little difference in the red lines and the green line. The red line shows the number of fatalities per 100 accidents. This is the number of people who die once an accident occurs. And in states with helmet laws and in states without helmet laws, that ratio is about the same across the board. To me, as a motorcyclist, that means that a helmet law isn't a fix. It's rather inconsequential in the whole picture. When we look at the number of fatalities per 10,000 registrations, which is how the state of Oregon and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration tends to measure these things, I believe that that's a measure of all the factors that come into play in preventing motorcycle accidents and injuries. That includes driver licensing, rider education, the awareness of other of auto drivers and other vehicles, of motorcyclists on the road not running over us. Many, many factors are at play here. When I was a member of the Blue Ribbon Panel, the Oregon Health Policy Institute, which was convened at the request of the Department of Health. It was, I have to say that when I first went into that meeting, I was apprehensive because I kind of felt like it would be a setup. I've seen all the medical studies. I've made a point of trying to understand what that all means. And that's the majority of evidence that's available for people to judge what is happening with helmets and helmet laws. The committee was charged with reviewing the evidence. The evidence as we find in published literature. And the published literature, the majority of it is from trauma centers. Doctors and medical professionals get advancement by publishing. And so there's quite a bit of that available. What is not available is, in a published form, is the experience of motorcyclists. And the committee, as we got into this discussion, gave me some, I'm not too sure how to describe it. It was gratifying to be recognized that the experience of motorcyclists may have some importance in understanding the whole picture. What we experience out on the road every day is not portrayed in literature. The fact that I talk to many motorcyclists around the nation who tell me their experiences and their knowledge about accidents that have happened. I've heard stories about people who were killed by a helmet catching on a foot peg in an accident. I've heard stories of people killed or injured. They feel, witnesses feel, that the helmet was a real factor there. I've talked to people who said, I think my helmet made me have an accident, got interfered with my ability to control the motorcycle in some way. These are all what's called anecdotal evidence. They're not recorded in the literature. There's very little effort on part of government agencies to do any research into this. It's kind of written off. So the fact that it does not exist in the literature does not mean that it does not exist. And as motorcyclists, we feel that the risks are large enough that we should not be subjected to a law that requires us across the board without any choice to wear a helmet. I think I've talked enough. Does anybody have any questions they'd like to
ask? Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually sort of see kind of a conflicting problem here with your transparency flip and the that's safe to listen to that. But I wanted to ask you, in the Oregon, and I understand that it's a statistically small sampling, but according to your chart here, in 1995, there were four fatalities per 100 accidents, which would be a death rate of 4%. Would you agree with that?
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Then do you know what the auto death rate is on a per 100 on a per 100 death? I'm just wondering if this is high or low compared to auto rate.
I'm sorry, I really can't answer that question.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure that helmets wouldn't prevent a lot of injury that that would occur in a motorcycle accident if a person were thrown out on the street. But the reason I have always defended the wearing of motorcycle helmets is because I felt they were effective in preventing brain injury. And have you, in the group you were working in, did you have any statistical information about that particular injury, brain trauma?
Within certain forces, helmets are capable of preventing head and brain injuries. There is no measure existing of where a helmet becomes incapable of preventing that injury. There's no measure. Helmets are tested in a lab with a head form. They are capable of preventing impact forces from being carried through to that head form up to about 13 miles per hour. And you have to consider that depending on how you impact, that's going to have an effect on what a helmet can do for you. Very high speed accidents, a helmet is not capable of treating them. But to the measure, it doesn't exist. We don't know if that's 10 miles an hour, 20 miles an hour, 80 miles an hour. And the fact that motorcyclists hate helmet laws so much, but we are the people who are subjected to wearing them, we feel should be a factor in how government governs us. Head injuries are still a real major problem in cars. And in spite of seat belts, in spite of airbags. But we don't see a motion to have all car drivers, all car occupants wear a helmet. And I think that's because it wouldn't be practical. People would object. We're a smaller population. We're objecting. But that's considered to be okay because the benefits are so clear. It's okay. You shouldn't object because the benefits are so clear. If you understand what I'm getting. I wear a helmet for many reasons. The more I learn about them, the more I think the helmet I'm wearing might not be an appropriate one. And I've studied this heavily. Most people out there who are subjected to this law don't have a clue. They put something on their head because the law tells them to. It may be a good helmet, it may be a bad helmet, it might fit, it might not. Knowledge is a much better tool. Rider education keeps them out of the accident in the first place. That's why we're so in support of it. I don't know if I've answered your question sufficiently.
Thank you, Teresa. Representative Hill, do you have a question? Sure. Representative Loken, and then Chuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the complaints that I've heard about repealing the Helmet Law has to do with the cost of insurance. I notice there's a reference to that in the governor's letter. And the anticipation that costs will increase. And that, according to other testimony that we have received from Mr. Stovall, is that voters were led to believe when they went to the polls in 1988 that a helmet law would lower insurance rates. He claims this has not come to pass. The risks are still there, just as they were before 1988, and the insurance industry knows it. But this has had no impact on rates. Do you have any information on this? I know I haven't seen any car insurance or other type of insurance decrease. The rates seem to continue to rise.
Representative Montgomery, Representative Logan. I guess the only thing that I really have heard about this is from representatives of the insurance agency, which says that they factor in to their rates the fact that some states have helmet laws and some states don't, and they're averaged out because people cross lines. I did not experience any decrease in my car insurance rates after the helmet law was passed. I don't believe we're going to experience any specific increase either, because the number of people, the number of accidents, the number of dollars that we're talking about here is so small in our total public health picture. When we regard the cost of smoking or heart disease or eating too much fat compared to this one, we are a drop in the bucket.
We have three more people to come before us. We have a couple more questions, then we'll move on. There's any stuff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, one of the arguments that people make, including the governor, as to why we should retain this law, is that it saves public funds because individuals do not have the severe head injuries, and these individuals, it is assumed, do not have insurance, and that we pick up that cost in the public and as private ratepayers to insurance premiums. My question to you, is there any reliable data out there that shows how many, in the past, how many motorcycle riders who were injured in an accident and had a head injury, how many of those were not covered by any insurance and the public actually had to pick up the cost of their medical care?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, a study was done in North Carolina a couple of years ago which specifically looked at this, and it appears that motorcyclists are just a pie, just a segment of the normal population. Whatever type of insurance you expect to find in the normal population is represented in motorcyclists also, which means that some of us are insured, some of us are not insured, some of us have lots of money and some of us don't. I don't think that there is any difference in the proportion, so that, yes, there is some cost, but it's not out of line with any other motor vehicle user.
Thank you.
Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two colleagues are talking about me.
That's a very long subject, isn't it?
In your earlier, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your earlier testimony, you indicated that a lot of parties that are injured in automobile accidents occur head injuries, and there's no effort to require automobile drivers to wear helmets. However, for I don't know how many years now, the federal government has mandated that new vehicles be equipped with driver-side airbags. Why don't you say that's an effort by government to reduce the level of injuries?
Mr. Chair and Representative Devlin, excuse me a moment. I guess my comment on that is that consumers have become aware of some deaths caused by airbags, and the federal government has responded by allowing a switch to be installed. And new cars are now, many of them, being equipped with a switch. The it seems that we're getting some response out of government regulators on that because the outcry from consumers has been heard. Yes, I do agree it's an attempt to reduce the number of injuries, and in many cases it's effective.
I would guess, you know, if Mr. Higginson was up here from the health department, he'd probably find statistics saying that the potentials for injury are far minor compared to the potential protection of injury by use of airbags, and that quite often the use of a switch is more intended for the use of what's now commonly when you have a passenger side airbag and a concern for young people that might be too small to sustain the impact of the airbag inflating. But clearly, I mean, government makes efforts in any way possible to reduce injuries and traffic deaths for them to control the cost.
Mr. Chair and Representative Devlin, I agree with you that the efforts are being made, but I also feel that sometimes mistakes are made.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel that there is a mistake being made here.
We're going to move on here. I know everybody's got a million questions. Mm-hmm. We will take two more questions, and then we're moving on because we've got four more people, and some of these questions possibly could be answered by some of our other people that are coming forward. We have ODOT and the traffic safety people. So we will go to Representative Hill, Representative Walker, and then we're moving. Hill, I know what your question is. Representative Hill, you may ask.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What happens to the human head when it hits the pavement at 35 miles an hour and is dragged along the pavement?
Teresa, years ago in my district, this question was asked four or five times on Monday, so I knew it was coming. I should have warned.
I think I had warning already. I think that you and I both know that if any part of our body is being dragged along the pavement, it's going to be injured. That what it hits is going to determine how bad that injury is. If it's a slide, you're going to rip a bunch of skin off, you get a bunch of rocks ground down, and it's going to be really ugly. If you hit a solid object, there's a real good chance you're going to sustain a brain injury. With or without a helmet, I believe, at 35 miles an hour. What that is, how severe it is, God only knows. You and I can't predict it ahead of time.
Thank you. Thank you for the answer. Griffin Walker?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question. I asked this question of Mr. Ray, and he wasn't certain of the answer. In the discussion section of the conclusions, this yellow part of the report, it said that all members of the panel believed there was protective value in wearing helmets under those circumstances. You were on the panel for OHCI studies. Do you agree with that conclusion?
Yes, I think I do.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Janet, do you have a question?
No.
Oh, you had one more question. Logan had a question.
I did. Thank you. Just a quick one. Getting back to insurance again. It's my understanding that you, as a motorcyclist, are required under your operator's manual to carry insurance, for bodily injury, property damage, and damage to others, and uninsured motorist coverage. Is that correct? Is that your understanding?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lopin, yes, I believe that's all correct. The uninsured motorists, I'm not positive about.
I think we have an answer on the panel.
Great.
Right. Thank you. Lopin, I looked into the insurance issue quite a bit last session. Motorcyclists in the statute are not required to have PIP, which is a personal injury protection. They have liability on their machines, that sort of thing. But this is part of the issue that in the statute, motorcycles are exempted under our requirements to have medical coverage in an accident, and that's part of the issue here.
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Loken, and there is a difference between medical and PIP also.
Mm-hmm.
Medical policies are available as an option on motorcycle policies. PIP, sometimes some companies, is available as an option, but not right.
Thank you very much for coming. Lyle, do you have any comments you'd like to make? Say your name for the record so everybody will know you were here.
Well, I'm Lyle Irons. I reside in the northeast corner of Klamath County, and I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be before the committee.
Thank you for coming up and being with us. I appreciate it very much. Next on the list is Troy. Would you like to come forward, please, from Department of Transportation, Traffic Safety?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Troy Kostolik. I am the Transportation Safety Division Manager for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm here this morning to provide testimony to you that the Oregon Department of Transportation is opposed to Senate Bill 583. Over the last two decades, there have been a lot of individuals involved in motorcycle safety programs, representatives from various interest groups, legislature, state government, local government, and has had a very positive impact on motorcycle safety. In the last 10 years since the reinstitution of the motorcycle helmet law, which was voter approved by more than 2-1 and passing in every county, the motorcycle fatality count in this state has dropped by more than 50%. On the second page of my handout, the lower bar graph is color-coded to give you an idea of when in the 1970s Oregon had a helmet law, from late 1970s through 1988 without a helmet law, and then the white bars on the far right since the helmet law was put back in place. Without a helmet law, the average fatality count for motorcyclists was 68 in the last 11 years, that averages below 30. In states that enacted mandatory helmet laws since 1989, there's been a significant reduction in fatalities. Oregon, 33% or higher. Texas, 23%. California, 37%. Washington, 15%. And there are others. There are currently 22 states that have laws that cover everybody. There are no provisions, including Washington, Oregon, California, and Nevada, as far as in this area of the United States. A comment was made as far as the question asked about fatalities per number of accidents comparing motorcycles to passenger cars, approximately 530 motor vehicle fatalities for 52,000 motor vehicle crashes. Also, would like to make one last point, and that is in motorcycle crashes, 80% of the crashes that are reported include some sort of injury or death. In passenger cars, it is around 40% include injury or death. I'd be happy to take any questions or possibly answer questions from previous testimony at this time.
Are there any questions? Any hands going up? Thank you very much for being with us. You'll be around in case something comes up.
Yes, I will.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bob Avery, I was here with Representative Jim Welch. Thank you. Morning, Bob. Thanks for coming.
Good morning.
For waiting us out, and thanks for coming back.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee. I'm Bob Avery. I'm from Junction City, Oregon. I'm an aide to Representative Jim Welch, and I'm here on his behalf. In addition, I've owned and operated several small businesses both here in Oregon and in other parts of the country, and I've been on motorcycles for over 27 years. I'm here to ask you to support Senate Bill 583. I believe that most of the technical reasons have been covered by some of the other people that have been here already, and I'll try not to duplicate that testimony. We're very concerned
we're all very concerned in one fashion or another on the motorcycle safety, or we wouldn't be here. The motorcyclist is the one that faces the threat of injury or death every time he goes out and rides. You've seen the room here full. If they were convinced that helmet laws work as they've been proposed, you've seen our actions in other areas, they'd be stomping here to tell you to make it mandatory, continue to make it mandatory. That hasn't been the case. The overwhelming theme for everyone that's been here has been freedom. Our system of justice was set up so that no one group could impose an unfair burden on another group. And that's exactly what's happened here with helmet laws. One group of unaffected people, the voters, the mass of voters, has taken away the freedoms of another over a perceived burden that time and again has been shown doesn't truly exist in the way we've seen it. You've had the OHP report. I won't get into all of that, but if you read it the way I did, I see that it says that helmets are probably a good idea, but we can't define how much they really truly save dollars and cents from the people of Oregon. And I think that's very frustrating when you consider that they looked at over 135 studies, it's my understanding, in that number range anyway. The most serious part of what my concern is, I think we can all agree that helmets do not prevent accidents. They don't stop the accident from occurring. They can only change the results of the accidents that do occur. And here in Oregon, those results are dismal. When you compare the number of, the total number of accidents are definitely down. Helmet's not going to stop that accident. But for every 100 people that's in an accident, more of us are dying. That rate has increased 41% since the mandatory helmet law went into effect. Now, I'm tired of seeing my friends and relatives and possibly myself be killed at this point. There's now, before the helmet law came into effect, there 4.6 people died for every 100 accidents here, every 100 recorded accidents here in Oregon. After the helmet law went into effect, 6.5 people died. I have to ask why. I believe that to look at this question, this issue, without looking at the per 100 accidents is incomplete and possibly intentionally misleading. Yet report after report doesn't look at the number of accidents. You just heard the gentleman from ODOT talk about the total reduction in fatalities. He didn't talk about the number of accidents that were reduced. He talked about the total number of fatalities. I need to ask that question, why? When compared around the country, the average number of deaths per accident, which is the only time a helmet's going to be effective, is essentially the same in helmeted states versus unhelmeted states. And none in 19, when I looked at a chart that I believe was provided by Senator George, none in 1993, none of the voluntary use helmet law states was as bad as Oregon is. Oregon's almost two times what the national average is. I believe that the experiment has lasted long enough, it has not demonstrated the clear results voters thought we were getting when we approved the referral, and it's time to correct that and give this group of people back their freedom. That's my prepared text. I've attached a chart which shows the number of accidents and the number of people killed, and that was developed off of a report from ODOT, just taking the numbers right off of that. Prior to 1985, those numbers were not available from ODOT, and I pulled those off the Motorcycle Industry Council. I do want to add on a personal note, and I hope that my sense of personal rage and frustration is coming through here. I believe that, I'm not the scientist, I'm not the doctor, but I believe that this emphasis on the helmet issue has kept the why from being asked. I think that the misinformation that's put out from the various health people and safety people is part of that. In the Senate, when we had testimony in the Senate, the Oregon School of Medicine told us that if we allowed riders to be unhelmeted, that there would be a 73%, helmeted riders have up to a 73% lower fatality rate than unhelmeted riders.
if that's true, why did it increase 41% here in Oregon? There's something like 130% wrong. Help me understand this.
We've got a bunch of questions up here, Bob.
I'm sorry. Certainly.
We can start that. You're just proving that everybody can read figures different. Thank you.
Certainly.
Reverend Lennon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your third paragraph in your letter talks about it. One of the people imposing an unfair burden on others.
That's correct.
Isn't our system of government set up that basically allows 51% of the people to impose burdens on the other 49%?
That's true, but when you have a minority, which motorcyclists are in this state, there's only something like 60,000 registered motorcycles. I don't recall exactly the number of motorcycle-endorsed people, but they're a small minority of the total voting population. There's no way that we could have afforded to educate the people like we've been educating you folks on what the real concerns are. It makes a very emotional, very dramatic statement to say that this helmet's going to save somebody's life and reduce our costs, but we don't have the ability to communicate that way.
In my community, I had the same argument with Baron Kruger, ban on Baron Kruger hunting, where a urban population forbid groups of my constituents doing what they want to do.
Exactly. That's why you hear that issue brought up here.
Sure. Ballot Measure 5 might be another one where you would people who support local schools say, my ability to pay local property taxes to fund schools the level that I want to fund them is taken away by a majority that said we ought to control property taxes. Isn't that an unfair burden on them?
Yes.
And final question is, what role do the legislature should play in any other initiative or referral passed by the voters? Should the legislature go back and look at all of those and say, we're going to change them because we think the voters made a mistake in what they did and what they enacted? Or should we just look at this one by itself?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, I don't believe that we should look at everything. You know, we're here, everything in terms of changing the will of the people, if you will. But I don't believe that the will of the people, that the people knew and understood that more people are dying now than were dying before they passed that law. And I don't think that we as motorcyclists can have the ability to communicate that to people. And I think that that's why we're here to tweak that law, to adjust that law, to make that change.
Thank you, Bob. President Loken, and then Jill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We, as we all know, we've been struggling with this issue over several sessions. I heard a lot of testimony from interested people in the last session. And how do you think this bill is different from before? Why do you think this bill could have legs and the other one didn't?
Certainly. I believe, and I don't know that the bill itself is that much different, but I think that we've got two very different circumstances. I believe the governor had bad information when he vetoed the bill last year. In the fiscal impact study, it talked about millions of dollars being additional costs to the people of Oregon. If you look at the fiscal impact study this year and after the OHIP, after you had the Blue Ribbon Panel look at all the studies, they said, we can't determine how big that cost is. And in my estimation, that we can't determine is we can't make it as big as was represented in the past. The other thing that we have that's different is what I've just handed out to you. There, in the past, we now have 10 years of data that shows that more people die per accident after the helmet law was in effect than before. And I would hope, Mr. Chair and Representative Lehman, those that have the ear of the governor would communicate that question and that problem to the governor.
Thank you, Representative Hill, and then Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me help try to give you some possible answers as to why, you know, the numbers there. I mean, you've got increased population. So you have a higher density in traffic, so the traffic conditions have changed from 1977 to 1999. You have road conditions have changed. Motorcycles are faster now than they were in 1977. So you have a different population, and the popularity of motorcycle riding has changed, and so the demographics have changed. So that can be part of it. The data that you're looking at has not been adjusted for those who are wearing helmets or not wearing helmets at the time of the accident. So who knows in terms of what that is.
There's plenty of ways to sit there and you can sit there and you can, now you pick out this one thing and now you got this increase 41%. Well, I can also sit here and say, gosh, you know, prior to 1900, there were no accidents on motorcycles. Nobody got killed on a motorcycle before 1900, you know. So therefore, let's get rid of motorcycles. Because look at the staggering increase of the rate of death in a motorcycle ridership after 1900. I mean, I think in terms of if you need to go out and do it. If you want to do this, you need to collect better data. Go out and work with the state police and so in motorcycle accidents so that and get the reporting forms changed so we collect the appropriate data so that you have a scientific basis versus just simply pulling numbers off a shelf and we can all sit up here and we can all determine what they are. But in terms of, I don't think you have met your case in terms of the fundamental fact that everybody knows you wear a helmet, you hit the ground. In certain circumstances, depending on speed, it's not going to help you. I acknowledge that. But in lower speed accidents, it can save a life. And I'm willing to bet and throw my vote to where we're saving a life versus not saving a life. And until you can come and show me that in these lower speed accidents in terms of where you're risking brain injury, which are debilitating and expensive long-term expenditures that this state's going to pay for as a result of someone else's perceived freedom. Mr. Chair here has been trying to share with us as we've gone through this session that driving is a privilege. It is not a right. So no one has a right to drive on the roads of this state in any condition other than what we prescribe them to do. So it's not a freedom. It may be something that you don't like, and you would much rather be unencumbered and let the wind blow through your hair. That's fine. But in terms of the associated costs with that, and I think in terms of this comes down to whether we can save a life or not save a life, I'm throwing my vote to where we can save a life. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I'll go there and rather than on the other side of that equation.
I think that was a statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, just briefly to follow up with Representative Hill's line of questioning. The traffic mix has changed. It's gotten a lot more dense in certain areas. It amazes me, though, that because of that, we still have a number of accidents are down. Why is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Croft, that's my precise concern, my precise reasoning here. I believe the number of accidents are down for a lot of reasons. I'm not a statistician, have the ability to analyze it, but I believe that that's because of the training. I believe wholeheartedly that that's because of the training. To come back to one of the points that Representative Hill was making, with the higher density, California has a much higher density than we have, and yet they have their fatality rate per 100 accidents is only 2.85 in 1983. I think that there's a lot of reasons why the total accidents are going down. I think that the issue hasn't been looked at in full, and that's the main emphasis, I guess, of what I'm saying, that this issue is clouding that. This issue is keeping us from looking at that completely.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. One last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you have any reliable data that would support Representative Hill's contention that there will be millions of dollars spent in public money to support the, for many years, the medical costs of individuals who are injured riding on a motorcycle and are not wearing a helmet?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, there are a number of studies that have looked at that, and there are a number of studies that have extreme flaws in them. NHTSA did a study on that. They call it the CODES report. They counted, and when it talked about dramatic increases in the medical costs. When we analyzed the study, it turns out that if 95% of my medical bill from a motorcycle accident was covered by my personal funds and insurance, and 5% was covered by government funds, they treated the entire cost of that accident as if it were a government, you know, public funds. That's just plain wrong.
it's an abuse of the funds that they had to study the issue. And we see that time and time, kind of thing time and time again. I think the earlier, a good study is that North Carolina study that Teresa referred to earlier, which said that we're essentially similar to everyone else.
Thank you, Bob. We'll move on to the next person. We have one other person on our list. If there's no more comments, I hope there wasn't. Sherman Pence. Oh, maybe I mispronounced your name. I tried. Okay. I can't read your writing, partner. Thank you. Thanks for being here. Morning. Thanks for coming back.
Morning, Chair Montgomery, members of the committee. As you bear with me, this is my first time in the legislative process, but I feel very strongly about the Senate bill, and thought of my duty to be here to speak my opinion on my support of Senate Bill 583.
It's your duty to be here anytime you want to, sir, and we welcome you very much. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Chair Montgomery. Appreciate it. First off, the first paragraph of my testimony deals with statistics, studies, and the like, and interpretation of those statistics and studies, as Representative Hill pointed out moments ago, and other members of the committee pointed out, you can get those studies and statistics to say what you want depending on your interpretation of those studies and statistics. And I cite two instances, some copies of testimony from Monday's meeting, whereby the state of Oregon used the OHPI study to support their argument, and Bike Pack of Oregon used that same study to support their side of the argument. Secondly, I have been a motorcyclist for 36 years. I have continuously improved my defensive driving techniques to avoid accidents, and fortunately, for 36 years, I have not had one. As some members have pointed out, accidents are accidents, and they happen without warning. But I believe my training in defensive driving has kept me out of a number of accidents. I prefer to ride without a helmet. I believe that since I am of the age of consent to the state, it should be my right to ride without a helmet. Thank you very much for your time, and I will answer any questions.
Well, thank you for taking time out of your busy day to be with us. I know you've got another life and have to make a living someplace, so we appreciate you coming back. Are there any questions of the committee? President Hill, did you want to ask your question? Go ahead.
No, I've asked enough. Okay. The answer hasn't changed.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and we seriously appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
We do have the governor's offices here. Did you want to comment, or just the delivering of the letter is fine? Thank you very much. We have no one else left to testify. We are in work session, as I mentioned when we opened the meeting. So, in work session, we have before us Senate Bill 583A. We have four or five decisions. What's the pleasure of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I move the Senate Bill 583 to the floor of the DuPass.
Thank you. Representative Krupp, move Senate Bill 583A to the floor of the DuPass recommendation. Any discussion of the committee?
Hello.
Representative Lehman, and then Representative. Yes, there's some discussion coming up. We have one other bill to hear, and we will go into that bill so we can get it out of here before 9:45, because we do have session at 10 o'clock today, and then again at 4 o'clock, and then again at 10 o'clock. Representative Lehman?
Sure. I'm going to vote no on the Senate Bill 4 for two reasons. Last session, actually, I missed on this. First session, I voted quarter fill all the way around. Second session, I voted out of committee and voted against it before. This is kind of a toss-up vote. If I was given the choice of voting for this on a ballot statewide, I'd vote to take this ban on, and strictly on what people have said. I've said many times people have the right to be stupid, and I think people have, voting like without a helmet is stupid, but I would stand up for people's right to do that and be stupid if they want. But the problem I've got is the voters enacted this on a 2-1 margin, It's very difficult for me to go in and counteract what the voters have done. I've got a bunch of things I'd love to go in and change if the voters have passed the state of Oregon. And I think when we start picking and choosing which of those things we're going to go in and change, we start down the proverbial slippery slope, and I think it's a difficult issue to go back in and decide what the voters want. I did indicate that I'd be willing to vote this bill out of committee if I thought that there was a chance that the governor's office view would change. We have a letter that indicates the governor hasn't changed his position. So voting this bill out of committee means to send it to the floor, another long floor discussion, spending a lot of time there, knowing that it faces the same result in the governor's office. I even went to talk to a representative, who indicated that I was told would carry water with the governor and try to go in and persuade him. And that representative said, yes, he would, but that he didn't think, in all likelihood, he was going to change the governor's mind on it. So I guess I'm looking at this saying, at this point, this bill is probably dead one place or another, and just as well here, that I'm not willing to go against the voters of the state of Oregon in this committee this time just to pass a bill out to the floor that, counteracts their will and votes the governor for a veto.
Thank you, Representative Lehman. Representative Stone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The speaker before the last one helped me with the statistics a little more. I was reading the wrong line on the overlay that the one lady had given us, and so actually 6.5 injuries per 100 would mean a 6.5% death rate. 530 fatalities and 52,000 accidents with autos is approximately a 1.1% death rate. I guess it just means that when you have something around you, you're going to die less often. I had a friend that actually is an athlete of ours when I worked at Lewis and Clark. He gave his girlfriend his helmet because he didn't have two. Truck pulled out in front of him. He died. She didn't. She was beat up pretty bad, but I found that I find that kind of interesting that she survived. Maybe it was because she was sitting behind him and he took the brunt of the force. I don't know. If you want to know what happens to your head when you get hit, a very good example, I guess, is take a glass, fill it with water, and drop an egg in, and then tip the side of the glass, and you'll watch the ripple, and you'll see the egg move. If the force is great enough, the egg will go over and hit the opposite side of the glass and then drift back. That's what happens to your brain when you have a force against your head. If you take a piece of foam, or styrofoam actually would be the best thing because that's the kind of thing that helmets are made out of, put that between the glass and your force and then watch what happens. What you'll see is that the egg doesn't move as much. The reason why I know this is because we've had the same debate with football helmets. I'm an athletic trainer. We've had the same debate with football helmets. And, of course, one of the debates also with football helmets was with regards to the face mask and how the face mask was causing more neck injuries. And actually, the helmets were causing more neck injuries because of the way that when the head got hyperextended or hyperflexed, and then the force of the helmet against the neck would cause a fracture dislocation. Of course, when we're talking about these kinds of G-forces that are being placed on the head and the neck, I think the fulcrum point is not that well made. With regards to lifestyle changes, I absolutely agree. And that was one point that was made, and the point was brought up about smoking. And absolutely, I think that if somebody's going to be stupid enough to smoke, why should we as a public have to pay for it? But that's exactly what happens. And now, of course, there's all the lawsuits against the tobacco companies, and I don't know, maybe pretty soon they'll start being lawsuits against helmet companies. I think that medical insurance on a motorcycle, insurance policy should probably be mandatory, but I'm not going to go there. And I think with regards to changing the will of the voters, what happens is that it's just a matter of the squeaky wheel that's the grease. We see this time and time again. One of the latest was in 1996 when the voters said that victims should have rights in criminal cases, and of course, the squeaky wheel took that to court and got the court to overturn it. So now we're back here again having the same discussion. I don't like overturning the will of the voters. I don't think that it's
I don't think that it's a wise thing for us to do. However, and the letter from the governor, I think, pretty well stakes out his position on it. But go ahead and go try to convince the governor to sign the bill as opposed to vetoing it. I think that when we look at all of the things with respect to it, you know, you can make the figures say anything you want to. So I'm going to go ahead and vote in favor of sending this out to the floor. I'm not sure that I'm going to be a yes vote on the floor, and I reserve that. But at this point, I will vote to go ahead and send this out of committee. But I think that this bill has a tough road to hoe.
Thank you, Representative Walker, and then we will vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be a no vote today, and I have 7 reasons to vote no, and they can be very brief. Voters passed a law by a 2-to-1 margin in 1988. In 1997, a survey conducted by Davis and Hood indicated sentiment hasn't changed much. In fact, it's 3-to-1. There was a letter in my local paper from a woman whose husband died 20 years ago who wanted freedom, rode without a helmet, was in a coma for several months, his children watched him die, and he finally did die. I had a high school friend who was an intelligent young man, and today he isn't. Today he walks around with assistance, and he doesn't think for himself very well. The study by OHPI is clear and convincing. Even Ken Ray said the study group had no agenda in regards to helmet use, included a member of Bike Pack. That report that I asked both people yesterday, on Monday and today, all members of the panel believed there was protective value in wearing helmets under most circumstances. I don't know how you can argue with that. The primary issue for motorcycle advocacy groups is the mandatory nature of the law, not necessarily the protection afforded by the helmet use. Ken Ray also responded to a question by Representative Hill that I transcribed. Representative Hill asked him, do you want a helmet or not, if you look like you're going to be in an accident? He says, Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, if I knew ahead of time I was going to have an accident, I'd certainly wear a helmet. I just don't believe that I will know that ahead of time, precisely my point. And my daughter, we talked about this at the dinner table this weekend. My daughter really had some very telling comments. She says, Mom, do we value anyone less because they're over 21? The answer to that is no. And in states where there is the age differentiation, where young people can have to have helmets and older people do not, there's more, according to Brad Higby, emergency room doctors have said there were more than 60% of the minors killed in motorcycle crashes were not using helmets, even though the law required them to do so. And it's also very difficult for a police officer to tell someone that's under 21 or over 21. And most importantly and finally, the governor's going to veto this darn thing. I'm going to pull a Senator Miller, and he didn't let the family leave law bill, the family leave bill come out of committee because he knew it was a worthless fight. And this is a worthless fight. The governor's going to veto it. I don't think the votes are there to override the veto, and I'm not going to waste people's time on it anymore. So that's the reason I'm voting no.
Thank you, Reverend Walker. Very short question, and then we will vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to vote yes for this. I have cracked a motorcycle. I crashed an airplane. Didn't have a helmet on either time. When you get in an airplane, when you get on a motorbike, you assume a certain risk. They are a heck of a lot more dangerous than getting in your car with an airbag and going down the road. Now I'm a firefighter, and I've picked up bodies from motorcycle riders. I've picked up bodies from people with cars and with airbags. Airbags survive a heck of a lot better. You're an adult. You get on a motorbike, you assume a risk. If you crash into something like you do in an airplane, your chances of surviving are not good. You're going to get hurt no matter what you do. That's what happened to me. There's very little data here for me to support some of the arguments that why we should keep this bill in place. I'm going to vote for this thing because I think it is an issue of personal freedom, and I don't think that anyone has proven my satisfaction that this is a burden on the public. So I'm going to vote yes.
Thank you all very much. My colleague here from Coos Bay indicated if you didn't wear a helmet, you were stupid. I don't think he meant to imply that, I think he meant to say you were ill-advised not to wear a helmet.
Trying to save you.
I was just going to explain. I think that explains a lot by Representative Krupp, all these crashes you get without a helmet on.
We've degenerated here. Representative
Mr. Chairman, personal privilege here.
Brad, would you call the roll? Clerk, call the roll, please. We're voting on Senate Bill 583A, the helmet law. Please call the roll.
No.
No.
Yes.
Representative Trumbull. Aye. Representative Lincoln. No. Representative Walker.
No.
Representative
Walker.
Aye.
Representative Montgomery.
Aye. 5-5, that's the tie, and that doesn't make it.
Four.
Oh, we have Taylor in the four. Well, still going to make it. For the benefit of the audience, we need 6 votes to pass anything.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor is here.
You want to be recorded on this again?
Thank
Taylor?
You. No.
She doesn't. Okay, thank you. I didn't hear it down on my end. Senate Bill 583 did not pass. Didn't matter whether she was here or not for the benefit of the audience. It takes 6 votes to pass anything out of committee. Even if there's only 6 people here, it takes 6 votes. Senate Bill 583 is not passed. Next item on our agenda is Senate Bill 1118A. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1118A. Janet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1118, and you should have the A and girls version of the bill. It was amended in the Senate. Increases the fee for the student driver training fund by $1. If you look at the bill, it cover the changes, but it's on page 2, line 18, which is sub 20 of the section for the driver training fund eligibility fee. Will go from $2 to $3. This is a fee that goes to fund some of the driver education programs in schools. The driver education programs are discussed when we discuss the teenage driver bill and how those are funded. Some of them are subsidized and some have quite a bit of the fee paid by the student family. This would increase the fee going to that program. This fee is paid when you get a new driver's license and when you renew your driver's license every 4 years. I wanted to point out to the committee that the fiscal statement for the A and growth bill reflects what Senate Bill 1118 would have done if House Bill 2193 had not passed. That was the bill that changed our driver licensing from a 4 to an 8-year period. It went through this committee early in session. It has passed the Senate and been signed by the governor. So we'll be going to an 8-year driver license cycle. So in order to get the funds that the sponsors and the Senate expected from Senate Bill 1118, there will need to be a conceptual amendment so it can adjust for that 8-year cycle. And in fact, we need to make the fee be $6 instead of $4, instead of $3.
It's no increase over this. It's just the amount of collection time that we're talking about.
Right. So, but it will. We did talk to Registered Council yesterday. They understand how the conceptual amendment needs to be drafted, but it will appear as $6 by October 1st, 2000, when this bill, that increase for 21, or excuse me, that extending to 8 years takes effect.
Well, thank you. We have 5 people signed up to testify, and we'll just start right down the list here, and we thank you all very much for waiting with us. Frank West is the first on the list. I know all of you are for this bill, so, and I see that there's someone with you. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. If you don't mind, I'd like to testify with Frank this morning.
Thank you very much. Yes, we appreciate it.
We're here representing the Oregon Traffic Safety Education Association, which is the state driver's ed teachers. Frank West is a board member of that group and an active driver's education teacher as well. So he's here to back me up on those details that I'm foggy on. Our organization supports Senate Bill 1118. Just a sidelight, I want to point out that this bill or this concept was part of the transportation bill that almost passed in the last session. There was really no concern about it from anybody. Unfortunately, that bill didn't pass, as you all know the history of that, but it would have happened the last time around. Driver's education is an effective program. There are some studies that show inconclusive results as to how effective driver's ed is. We believe that those studies really evaluate the curricula more than the driver's education itself. If you really look at some programs are quite effective. For instance, the state of Washington has a very effective program that is an integrated program of driver's education and a graduated driver's license program, such as Senate Bill 24 or House Bill 2440, which you all passed out several weeks ago. But the state of Washington program has been very effective, and I think that what the state intends to do is model the program after that California or the Washington program. Also, recently there was a study done for students who've taken driver's ed in the Lake Oswego School District, and that too showed that the kids in Lake Oswego who had driver's ed were better drivers. Basically, just to sum up, Senate Bill 1118 coupled with House Bill 2440, we believe will save kids' lives, and we urge your support.
Thank you, Mike. Frank, did you have any comments?
I would just like to add a personal observation. And
for the record, you say you're
Frank West, I teach at Cass State High School just out east up here. What I've seen happening over the years with our school funding situation is the ever-increasing squeeze on programs that aren't required or aren't mandated. And this has happened to driver's ed in various districts. District right next to us, Satan, district dropped their driver's ed program about 4 years ago. We've been able to help them some by picking up some of their students, but some of them I realize have not gotten that training because it's not available. Pure and simple matter, the school district felt they could not afford it. I feel that the additional funding from the state would help save some of those programs where they're coming down to that squeeze. If there's more reimbursement coming to those school districts, it may enable them to keep the program available for kids.
Thank you. We have a couple questions here. We have three or four questions. Representative Wells, Walker, and Wilson.
Thank you. At Cascade, do the parents pay any of the cost? How do you pay for your program? How much money does the district pick up of the program? If you're getting $100 or $115 of this, then who pays the rest of it?
Each student is required, and parents can pay $40. This coming year, it will be $40 per student. If it's a student who is outside of the district, they will pay $140.
So the district is picking up $70 or $80, $90 out of their general fund?
Yes, or more.
Is there any desire to increase the parental cost?
That did happen this year. We went from 30 to 40 for our own students, and for those outside the district, we went from 100 to 125.
Professor Walker?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish I had the foresight to get my notes from bill that we talked about, teen drivers. We went into great detail about this issue. And I remember the discussion that raising $1 wasn't a whole lot of money, a lot of money, that we'd be better off if we could raise it more. Was there ever was the original bill, I'm not sitting very well today, I'm very tired. Was the original bill asking for any more money, or was it always your intent just to ask for $1? Did you think that's about all you could get?
I think we thought that's about all we could do.
Okay, that's really the bottom line for me.
I should point out that a dollar increase or a $2 increase on the 8-year basis, that's just 25 cents per year,
yeah,
which is pretty cheap insurance to have better drivers out there on the road.
Thank you, Representative Logan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, who conducts the test of this? Is it privatized? Is it school personnel? Is it ODOT personnel? Who is handling that right now?
The testing for students,
Well, excuse me, the training, driver education, I'm sorry.
The majority of it is done through the individual districts, the schools, but there is a large part of it that also comes from privatized organizations or schools that sometimes contract through the school district to perform the service for them for a certain fee, and some of them are just out there on their own for purposes of some driving schools, and students or adults, for that matter, then contract with them individually for the training and the testing.
Follow up.
Yes.
Is there any comparison to the cost on that, whether it's done by private organizations or whether it's done internally?
I don't know of any studies that have been done to say who can do it more cheaply, if that's the intent of the question.
That is.
I don't know of the studies, and my observation, at least in our own district, it would cost our students more to go someplace else and get it under a private cost, but that's because it's being subsidized by out of other district funds. So.
Thank you both very much for coming. We have three other people on our list here, and we're sure that they get their support. Catherine, I can't pronounce the last name. I apologize. Thank you.
Just start.
Seems like a gentleman up here does no useful. Okay. Thank you for being with us today, and thanks for waiting us out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Dysett. I'm the communications director for the Salem-Keizer School District, and this bill was introduced at our request. And I believe I can answer many of the questions that you brought up under the first conferee. Our primary issue with the current status of the driver's training fund is that there is not enough money in it to adequately reimburse districts at the $150 rate that is in the current statutory language. As the number of students enrolled had increased over the years, the funds had been prorated, and they are, in fact, reimbursed in the year following that in which expenses are incurred. In our school district, it costs us about $300 a student to offer driver's education. Parents pay tuition. The only time our general fund is impacted is when the reimbursement comes in short of what it was we estimated, and so there is a fallback to our general fund. So, for example, if we anticipate $150 reimbursement from the state and only receive $90, as has happened to us on occasion, then our general fund must absorb the difference between the tuition that was charged because of our own underestimate based upon the assumptions of the reimbursement and that which actually came through the following year when the State Department of Education distributed the funds to us. In answer to the question that Representative Walker raised, I believe, about had we intended for the original dollars to be higher, the answer is yes. We had originally talked about a $2 increase rather than a $1 increase, but were assured at the time by the Department of Transportation and Education that $1 would adequately cover the projected enrollments for the next few years. Obviously, the change in your own schedule of renewal, as well as any change in the requirement of how many students might or might not be encouraged to take driver's education, would alter that as well.
Thank you, Representative Levin.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Lansford, how much is the tuition that you're currently charging the Salem-Keizer School District?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lehman, it varies based upon what we estimate or actually guesstimate we will get in reimbursement. It has been as high as $120. It has been as low as $112. And in one single semester, it was, I think, 147, because that was in the year when the State Department administration reinterpreted the law and chose to not reimburse us at all because we were contracting out for the service. We've been doing that for some time, but a new administrator of that program chose to reinterpret the law, and it was in the last session that we came back to the legislature and affirmed that was an appropriate choice.
Thanks, Representative.
You no longer contract out. This is school district employees that provide this program.
Mr. Chair, Representative Raymond, we contract out fully for this service. We contract with Oregon Drivers Training Institute, which is a private company based in Oregon they must, by your statute, hire certificated teachers, and in fact, most of the teachers that they hire are our teachers in their regular day. But because ODTI hires them to perform this service, they can do it at a rate that is below the per diem rate called for in our collective bargaining agreement, and we can offer the service more less expensively than if we did it ourselves.
Sure. And is this offered during the school day, and do they receive credit for classroom credit for this class?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lehman, it is not at this time, although there have been discussions as we've gone to block schedules about making it perhaps offered during the school day. Right now, it is offered before school, after school, and on weekends.
There's no credit given for it.
If you have someone else following through, they can answer that question when they come.
It's a lesson credit. Right. But that's up to the school district, and it varies from district to district.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Catherine, just quickly, if we pass this bill, what does it mean to your school district and your program in terms of dollars?
I will have to re-estimate the change that would be caused by the extension of the renewal and whether or not the fiscal note, as the bill is currently written with a $1 increase, I believe it would leave us insufficient funds given the other change that was made earlier in the session. Our purpose and hope was to get enough money in the student driver training fund that we could count on the $150 reimbursement and therefore make the program predictable to administer for us. Given the other bill that has passed this session, as the committee administrator explained to you, that may not be enough money.
So you don't have an estimate on how much the $1 will mean to you in terms of your reimbursement? How much additionally over what you're talking about in your testimony here?
Representative, I think that should not take a mathematical giant. It gives you one-third more money. And I hope that's your answer, because if it doesn't, there's something wrong with this whole thing and it shouldn't pass.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kopp, that is correct. It gives us an additional dollar. The fiscal note that was run on it would increase the fund a little more than $1 million a year, but that fiscal note was run at our behest before your previously passed bill that changed the driver's license renewal time. And so I
think the state did not skim anything off before we passed it through.
Mr. Chair,
yes or no?
I don't know the answer to that question.
I would ask Kelly Taylor then. I don't want to put you on the spot here, but
I think even though we're increasing the money in the fund, there still is really no guarantee for the reimbursement, because as the number of students go up that are now taking driver's education, the reimbursement drops back down again. So I think that's the problem we've got. Even with increasing this, we may not affect the reimbursement at all, because there'll be more kids out there that now have to take driver's ed because of what is going to be reimbursement.
Well, they need to chip in a little bit anyway.
But Mr. Chair, it bothers me that an attorney can read my mind.
It's a bright light.
Do you have a question?
Regardless of the helmet injury.
I just wanted to point out that the $1 million is statewide, and that the statewide figure for the amount raised.
Thank you.
Yeah, two more over here. We have Ann Smart, I believe it is, and you're okay. Good morning. Thank you very much for coming, and thanks for waiting to talk.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Smart Jackson, representing the Oregon Community College Association. With me is Ann Smart. She's the Dean of Extended Learning for Lynn Benton Community College. Community College Association supports this legislation. Currently, we have 5 schools that offer driver's education programs. They are Umpqua, Clackamas, Rogue, Lynn Benton, and Chemeketa. And Chemeketa is the newest program, and they have joined together with their local school districts to offer this, because the local school districts no longer can afford to provide this program to their students. I'd just like to echo everything that Sam Kaiser School District said. We believe that this will provide stability for our program, and in addition, will encourage more school districts to either retain their programs or to bring the programs back. Originally, our programs were designed for adults, and we're finding that we're receiving more and more youth in our program because they are no longer offered at the school districts. And we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Oh, thank you. Did you have any comments this morning?
I don't have anything to ask. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Do you have any questions,
Reverend
Walker?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My children go to driver's training at Lane Community College. They offer the program, but you don't list them here. Does that mean they don't get money reimbursed from the student driver training fund?
That's correct. I believe that's correct. They're not listed. These are the schools I know that receive the reimbursement, right? Mm-hmm. And they're in Representative Walker. I'll have to check on that for you.
Any further questions? Thank you both for coming, and thanks for waiting us out. We appreciate you being here and taking time to be with us.
Maybe I have one.
One? Would you like to ask Kelly Taylor that question?
Well, no, I'd like to ask the young lady from the community college. How do you administer your program? Is that through private organizations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loken, I believe that our schools offer that through their own programs. And not
I heard some testimony prior, that stated that there was some savings by going to an outside company, and I'm wondering if that might be a good thing in your situation to investigate.
Well, I'm sure we could investigate that. At this time, there's no private company in our rural district.
Maybe I didn't get what your rural district was.
Lynn and Benton's name.
This is surprising.
All right, thank you.
Thank you both very much for being here. We have gone through our list. I don't know if there's anyone else out in the audience. Kelly Taylor, do you have any comments on it with the Department of Transportation? Maybe briefly, if you have any comments to make, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. I would just offer help as you walk through the conceptual amendments to try to juggle the cost or the fee to match a 4-year cycle or an 8-year cycle, and offer some suggested effective dates, and I've costed it out to see, you know, what the money would be with those conceptual amendments. What I had talked with Chair Shannon on the Senate side when the bill came out is that we would need a delayed effective date just to try to get the programming timed with renewal notices, because these fees are collected both in original and renewal of driver's licenses, and we create the renewal reminder for the driver's license many weeks ahead of the birth date to get them out in the mail and get them to people to give them a chance to try to prepare to renew and know they're going to need to renew. And so Chair Shannon had understood that, and so I understand, Kelly, that you'll need, you know, probably an amendment on the other side to, you know, change the effective date from a 90-day bill to a future date. And so I'm just here to be able to help walk you through some possible conceptual amendments to keep the fee going and address that.
So what you're suggesting is we need to delay the startup date, or at least put it in the bill to make it March 1st, year 2000. Is that one of the suggestions?
That's correct. That's what I would suggest.
That needs to be amended other than line 18 changing the 3 to 6. Is that the...
Right. Mr. Chair, what I would suggest is that the bill have the bill for a $3 fee be effective March 1st, 2000, and go to $6 on October 1, 2000. And that way, when we go to an 8-year driver's license on October 1, 2000, the fee coincides so that the same amount of money would be collected in an 8-year period as it would have been 2 4-year periods.
So without any delaying tactics, we could go ahead and conceptually amend that today and get the thing moving forward, if that's the pleasure of the committee. Okay, thank you very much. I will ask my question to you. Do we take administrative fees off of this as we pass the money through to the school district?
Mr. Chair, yes, a very small amount just for the... for the cost in our financial services branch to cover our cost of collection and dispersal.
Not to put you on the spot, but I guess I am, and we all have different dictionaries. In your dictionary, what is very small? I mean, do you have a ballpark idea?
Mr. Chair, I don't know, but my understanding is it is very small.
Okay. And the Department of Education administers it, and I hope hope they don't.
I don't know what they
do. Very, very small.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
Randy's sitting back there.
Okay. We don't want to put him on the spot. We have a session in 10 minutes. Are there any discussions in the committee?
Mr. Chair, while we're confessionally amending it, and I don't know, maybe this gets more than what you want to do, but I would suggest that we limit the scheme, if you will, to no more than a 5% administrative fee.
Without knowledge of how much is taken now, I would prefer not to, but if that's the pleasure of the committee, we could. I would like to suggest that they will be prudent as we vote on their budget at other times.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, Reverend Trumbull, the reason that pretty standard language after directing expenses, et cetera, because if you don't do it, it's not constitutional because we can't use gas tax money to do this without that.
Oh, okay.
That's the purpose. And it's kept to exact cost of transferring it. And I will find out what it is for you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Kelly, for being with us. We will close the public hearing. We'll open the work session of Senate Bill 1118A. Janet, do you have some comments or the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out that under your place today was a fiscal impact statement that came from the Department of Transportation because we didn't have the information to our fiscal office in time. And it does take into account the March 1st delayed effective date where it would go to $3 and October 1st, 2000, $6 fee, and you can see what the 9901 and the 2103 amounts would be. But you should also note that because the money comes in early in the 8-year and has to be spread out over an 8-year cycle, those funds will drop significantly, so there will be a bump, large increase in the 2103, but that will taper off so that department's going to need to figure out how to kind of handle that, maybe put some funds aside to be able to keep up the reimbursement rate.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we amend Senate Bill 1118A as conceptually amended, and as I will ask Janet to articulate what these bills are going
to do. Okay, Mr. Chair, the language would be changed to read that up on March 1st, 2000, the fee would be increased from $2 to $3. And on October 1st, 2000, it will be increased to $6. That will be in the form of a conflict amendment that House Bill 2193 is going to be amended if this bill passes.
Thank you. Does everyone understand the motion?
Mm-hmm. Just to clarify, that it's for licenses that come up for renewal, not because that way, because they can, so they will be able to send out notices with the higher fee for anybody whose license comes renewed on that day. It's not a date certain. It's a date certain as it relates to renewal. That's the correct statement?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. People won't pay it until the renewal comes up. The reason that we're amending 2193 instead of this bill in the conflict amendment is because there is some language for transition because they're phasing in the other increases.
Does everyone understand the amendment? I hope you understand it better than I. is there any other? Yes, very brief.
Yes, it will be brief.
Yes,
just for the record, I think that as a caution, I believe that our school districts and community college districts who have this private education should really be looking at every way to make it cost effective, not only from the standpoint of the state and the schools, but also because of parents who contribute to this. And if it's cheaper to go outside and do it, I think they ought to do it.
I think it's encouraging to do it.
Absolutely.
I agree with you more, and I think the kids should also pay a little bit so they appreciate driving a lot more. Not a bunch, just a little bit. Is there any opposition to the conception amendment as mentioned by Janet? No opposition?
I move Senate 1118A as conception amended to the court to be recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Hill moves Senate Bill 1118 as conceptually amended to the floor of the due path recommendation. Representative Lane.
Sure, I can't let this pass without two observations. One is my objection to the original student driving and the young people driving, and I will bet you when this floor goes, the floor goes to the floor. There will be people who voted for that bill to get tough on young drivers who will then vote against this to fund student driving. The second thing is carrying out what Representative Wilson referred to. See, I find it very appalling that in school districts we're charging kids, and I'm not taking on the school district, we're being forced to charge kids to take something that we say is our big issue. We want to protect these young drivers. We're charging them to do that, to get class credit. We're charging kids. So if you got bucks, you play. If you don't have bucks, you don't do it. And again, as I said then, we love to talk tough, and we love to have these issues. We just don't want to pay for them.
Thank you. Will the clerk call the roll?
Aye. Is that on the record, Representative?
Yes. Yeah.
All right.
Representative Walker. Aye. Representative Wells. Yes. Representative Montgomery. Aye. Senate Bill 1118 is passed to the floor to do pass the recommendation as amended. Do we have a carrier?
Yes.
Sure.
Hey, Representative. Oh, no, let Representative Hill do it.
We'd like you to.
No, Representative.
No, no.
It's not. We'll carry the bill.
Wait a moment. Mr. Chair,
stay on it before I go. I hope no one voted no on the helmet bill because they were afraid I was going to carry it and wear leather on the floor.
Well,
I was just afraid you might wear it.